Here I am tonight. David Sirita is going to blow your socks off. David Sirita's first aspiration in life was to become an astronaut. In 1968, he and a friend witnessed a UFO along with hundreds of other witnesses. After that experience, David grew up as a UFO enthusiast, as you might imagine, never living in doubt of the phenomena that has swept the world since Roswell in 1947. His interest in space, religion, philosophy, astronomy, and science led him on his career in related fields. He studied world religion, science, physics, and paranormal psychology for over 25 years. So in a moment, and he's really got some audio that will blow your socks off tonight, in a moment, David Sirita. All right, just before I bring David on, Robert in Las Vegas, just over the hill from me, says, "Hey, Art, if you truly believe all of these things you fear," meaning Ed at Dames, "because you see the beginning of the truths all around you, then why did you choose to bring a new child into this doomed world? Shame on you." Well, first of all, I have not seen these things. Ed is the one who has seen these things. What I am acknowledging is that I'm certainly seeing the beginnings, and I don't see how you can not acknowledge that, and that goes for all the rest of you too, that these things he said so many years ago do seem to be around us. But I choose life. And I choose hope. And I guess I have faith, perhaps misplaced as it may be. I have faith in life and love. And what else carries us all on? All right, David Sirita, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Art.
Good evening.
I think I finally saw Pahrump, Nevada. I drove through it on my way out of Death Valley.
No kidding.
Is that your radio tower, the big red tower in the middle of town off the side of the highway?
Well, we have a red tower.
The red light.
No, not the red one. No. That's a cell tower.
Oh, okay. It was amazing.
We do have a tower. There's a tower as you come into town from the California side. Mm-hmm. That would be KNYE's tower. And then there's one here at my house as well. So towers all over the place. Anyway, David, apparently, let me read this. It says, David Sirita will present a fraction of the total video taped disclosure of a 72-year-old Boyd Bushman, Lockheed Martin senior researcher scientist of 20 years, program manager, top secret clearance, former employee of Howard Hughes, Texas Instruments, General Dynamics, and more. He designed the Red Eye missile, now the Stinger missile, infrared FLIR systems, and most importantly, he claims he reversed... He didn't, nothing about a claim. He reverse-engineered anti-gravity and UFO technology. Now, this man is 72 years old presently. Is that correct?
73
now.
Yes.
All right. When did you do this videotaping, David?
Well, it was kind of getting near the end of filming for my new movie, From Here to Andromeda, which is due out at the end of the month. And it's kind of a surprise. I had been in touch with Boyd Bushman through our friend John Hutchison for about 8 months now. Him and I have been emailing each other, and he's very, very, you know, secretive in the emails and on the phone calls. He just said, "Come to Texas and we'll talk."
Huh.
So finally, we went to Texas about a month ago. We got there and we meet this gentleman, and it's literally, I mean, when you're sitting in his presence, I mean, it's not an exaggeration to say that this man is beyond Einstein. It really isn't. And from my years of study, I've been around people like Glenn Seaborg, who chaired the Atomic Energy Commission under Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon, Bogdan Castle, Magwitch, who invented helium-3 fusion, Murray Gell-Mann. The list goes on and on and on. I've been around all of these guys and been able to pick their brains. There is nobody I've ever met who compares to this individual. Boyd.
All right, I guess, David, my first question would be, why would this man at 73 years of age decide now to tell this incredible, I mean, to do this kind of disclosure? What do you think motivated him, his age, or he wants the truth out, or he's, I mean, if what he says and what everybody's going to hear here in a little while is the truth, he's got to be violating all kinds of security oaths and God knows what else.
Well, firstly, remember the statement by Ben Rich, who was former head of Skunk Works at Lockheed? he said to disclosure witnesses that the Air Force has just given us a contract to take ET back home in a Wright-Patterson Air Force Base slide presentation in 93. And then at an alumni speech in at UCLA in 93, he said, we now have the technology to take ET back home. And amongst those statements, he said that we already have the means to travel among the stars, but these technologies are locked up in black projects, and it would take an act of God to ever get them out to benefit humanity. So
yes.
What we're having here is disclosure on camera of anti-gravity, proof that Roswell was an alien craft and that we shot it down, that these technologies have been, anti-gravity has been reverse engineered since the 50s. In fact, he actually shows documents that we'll go into later. And he actually demonstrates anti-gravity right in front of us, my fiance and I, on camera.
Oh my God.
And how it works is really not that hard to understand. It's not really that difficult. And I believe, to answer your question, the reason why.
Yes.
Think of the pledge of Gary McKinnon, you know, the computer hacker who hacks into the military computers and believes the government is hiding evidence and technology that could save the planet. I mean, environmental zero-point energy technology. And this man really feels that way. I mean, Boyd Bushman really feels that we are probably not going to survive, that we have to potentially go to another planet to transfer the human experience so that it can continue. And right now, if you really look at the headlines and we don't bury our heads in the sand, it's pretty obvious that at least a large portion of us are going to face extinction.
It is ominous, David. There's no question about it. It's ominous, very ominous. I'm very concerned. But again, so you're saying then that Boyd Bushman sat down with you and said that mankind, is at a crunch point. He believes that. That's what pushed him forward.
I think that's partially what motivated him, but I also think of the bell curve, which is that, you know, when technology is discovered and is tested in research labs and eventually it comes to fruition for humanity, I think they're so far beyond anti-gravity at this point. In fact, he's explicit in describing how far beyond anti-gravity we are, and it's very close to the statement, you know, by Ben Rich, that I think it's time that we have anti-gravity. And the reason is, just think of this logically for a minute. For example, all these new electric cars coming out, like Tesla Motors electric car, and you have this Zap X coming out that does 155 miles an hour and has 350 mile range on one set of batteries. You can recharge them in 4 hours. Now, what would happen? Because he actually demonstrates this in front of me. What would happen if I could cancel out 50% of the gravity on that vehicle? What would happen to the range? I mean, literally 50% of the weight charge in relation to gravity. If I could cancel out even 50% of it, the tires would still be on the ground.
Right, but it'd be very light. I can't do the physics. Sitting here, I can't do the physics. But
no.
Obviously, David,
it'll probably do 700 miles per charge.
Yeah.
A Hummer could do 35 or 40 miles per gallon. So just that much, just if they give us that much, let alone actually flying, and I think he gives us enough to actually fly, it's going to change everything. I mean, where we spend most of our energy in this quest towards sustainability and getting off foreign oil, which I think all Americans would agree that we need to do, if we can even reduce 25% of the energy we're using, I mean, in shipping, cargo containers, the weight of a cargo container, our motor vehicles, transporting food, I mean, goods, all of it, if we could reduce 25 to 50%, we would reduce greenhouse gas emissions by the same. Now, it's possible to reduce it 100% from what he's actually demonstrating. And I believe that the reason he's doing this is because we will not survive. He knows that we will not survive without it. And there's something else that he discloses in the film interview that is even more shocking than that about our own survival. But firstly, just the ecology, just on a sustainable level, this will change everything.
All right. What about his background, David? It says here, let's see, Lockheed Martin, senior researcher, a scientist, 20 years, program manager, top secret clearance, former employee of Howard Hughes, Texas Instruments, General Dynamics, and much more, the Red Eye missile. How much of his background were you able to confirm, David?
All of it. I mean, I went on the U.S. Patent Office where he has 26 filed patents that are not classified patents, and every single one of them has his name on it. In fact, he has one of the best. Let's just start here. I worked in landmine and bomb detection for a small defense contractor in Irvine, California. for national security, for airport security and landmine detection. And one of his patents is actually probably the best detection system for buried landmines I've ever seen. And it's actually, you know, it has Lockheed Martin's name on it and his name on it. And it's patent number 5,982,180. And it's called Tesla Lightning. He uses a Tesla coil to produce high-voltage sparks. And the sparks go right through the soil and map out. They literally target the metallic detonator on the landmines, and it takes a picture. And then you follow the trails, and you go and you find, you know, whatever the metal thing that is.
That's remarkable.
And it's remarkable that that is not even being used because it's brilliant. In fact, it's better than our system. We were using neutrons to radiate the soil to bounce back gamma signatures in the form of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and phosphorus. So, yeah, I mean, no matter how many patents I've looked at his on the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, they're all there. So we have someone who's, you know, in the process of disclosure. We had, you know, Bob Lazar back in the 1980s. We had astronaut Gordon Cooper testify that he saw UFOs. Major Bob White at Edwards Air Force Base, and when he was test flying the X-15, testified that he saw a UFO right outside of his window. That was in Time magazine.
Wait a minute, David. Does he actually verify what Lazar said?
What he does, there's one point when I asked Boyd Bushman in the interview, because he gives me so much information.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the reasons he picked me is because I'm very close myself in my own research into anti-gravity. In fact, I may have part of the problem solved that they don't have solved, and that's efficiency. But nevertheless, I asked him, does Lockheed have, you know, just like Ben Rich said, do they have this stuff perfected yet? And what he says to me is really peculiar. He says, I've given you the Lazar tapes, because he gave me these Bob Lazar tapes that are ancient. I mean, some of the earliest disclosure he ever made publicly. And he said, the reason I'm giving you those tapes is because they're from a white world form. And in the negative space of that, what he's saying is there's a non-white world form. And then he says, I can't tell you any more than that when I'm probing into Lockheed itself, when I'm actually probing into the company. But when I actually asked him about how does anti-gravity work and do we have it working, that's when he starts doing these little experiments in front of me that are so simple, one step at a time, all on camera. You get to the point that you can amplify them and you can understand how it's happening.
Right, so the first big revelation is the reduction of gravity or anti-gravity, if you will, right?
Okay, the first revolution is this. First, Bob Lazar told us that element 115, which is quite an astounding story, because element 115 at the time he disclosed it did not exist. At the Lawrence Livermore National Lab, or Lawrence Berkeley, one of the two, they finally developed 115, and the formula, if you put them side by side, and there are long math formulas, are almost identical to his. It's really exciting.
I'm seeming to recall that they did, in fact, discover 115, but that it was not stable. Is that correct?
It is not a stable element, but according to Lazar, it is stable. But what Boyd Bushman tells me, they've now developed elements that are far beyond 115, and they do start to stabilize up there, just like Bob Lazar predicted. But 115, at least our version of it, is not stable. No, it exists for a fraction of a second.
Well, by the way, that 115, I learned in an interview not very long ago, is still in somebody's possession.
It is. It is. And what Lazar first said, and I really believe Lazar's story is true, in that he did have access and he did have close contact with these, you know, reverse-engineered alien craft, and we'll get into the proof of that later, but his interpretation of what they're doing with 115 initially was that to produce a lot of gravity, if you want to fight gravity, if you want to actually fight it and counter it, you have to have a lot of mass energy equivalent, because mass, gravity, and energy are equivalent in equals mc squared.
Right.
Energy is equal to mass times the speed of light squared, and mass and gravity are in the same kind of a relationship. So what Boyd Bushman says to me is, that's not correct. We're not taught. He said there are a lot of scientists that are producing a lot of mass energy formulas to produce a lot of gravity to fight gravity and to move things around. And he said that's not what we're talking about at all. He's talking about the discovery, a radically new discovery of an additional four forces. Now, we have five forces that we know: gravity, magnetism, electromagnetism, which is light waves and radio waves and television, the strong nuclear force, which binds atoms together, which holds everything together, and then the weak force, which is the underlying force. And we have five senses, which is kind of interesting. We have the five physical senses. And we think of the sixth sense being an extension, or an extension beyond the known senses. Boyd points out that the sixth force is not a force that's repelling gravity or fighting it. It's free of gravity, and they call that the expansion force in the universe, which is already identified. That's the force that's causing the galaxies to drift apart or the universe to expand. And it's actually stronger than gravity. So if you can enter that sixth force as an actual material spacecraft, you become free of gravity and inertia, which means you can do high-speed turns. There's no G-forces on high-speed turns. Gravity has no effect on you. And once you reach that place, the energy that it takes to go the speed of light and beyond is tiny, insignificant amounts of energy. So the whole emphasis, and I've been saying this all along, is it's not, you don't want to fight inertia. Inertia is both a body in motion and the tendency of a body in motion to resist acceleration, which is, for example, when you stick your head out the window of a car doing 90 miles an hour, your head blows back, right? So the wind, the air has mass and it's pushing on you. It's producing what pilots call drag. So you can only go so fast through the air mass. And then when you get out of air mass, you get into space and you think, wow, now that I'm in space, I can go any speed I want. Well, that's actually not true. Space is full of mass. And in fact, you're pushing through a fabric. And the faster you go, if you could even get to one-tenth the speed of light, which is 67 million miles an hour or 186,282 miles per second. Now, if you could go that fast and all of a sudden there's an asteroid right in front of you and you got to turn right to avoid a collision, the G-forces on the turn are going to kill you.
All right, this resistance in space that you're talking about, David, is this what the scientists or the physicists are calling dark matter?
There's a competition between dark energy and dark matter. And the expansion force actually wins the competition. So gravity is the weaker of the two forces. So now what Boyd Bushman says is they've already discovered force number 6, 7, 8, and 9. And what force 7, 8, see, they anti-gravity they've had since Roswell. And what I'm going to play for the audience is an actual audio clip of Boyd Bushman. Now looking at his credibility and what he's about to say here is he personally is friends with a Navy doctor who he says, because I knew you were coming, meaning me, he called a friend of his who's a Navy doctor during the time of Roswell. And this particular Navy doctor treated a pilot who actually shot down the Roswell UFO. The question is, with what and how? So can I play the clip or should we do it later?
Just a couple of things that I want to clarify. Does he verify Area 51 in the sense that it was an area where, as Bob Lazar told us all, they were testing alien craft?
Absolutely. I mean, that is affirmative, 100% affirmative that he, in fact, that was one of the most shocking things he said initially when I asked him about, some of these UFOs people are seeing, are they ours? And he immediately goes into Area 51, which, of course, officially doesn't exist. So here is a Lockheed senior scientist with, top secret clearance, who designed the Stinger missile for General Dynamics, and he's moved on to Lockheed for 20 years, and he's telling you that not only does it exist, but because so many people were encroaching in on it, they moved it. And he tells you in the film where they moved it. So it's like he wants us to know this stuff.
All right, now, you're suggesting or you're telling me that he said he knows who shot down the Roswell craft.
Yes, he does. The mystery is the weapon with which, because bullets were only 1,500 miles an hour, and that's the first thing I said is, oh, my God, you couldn't have done with a bullet, and he just started laughing. No way. There's no way it was a bullet.
Oh, my God is right. All right. Well, we'll find out what it was in a moment. David, stay right where you are. We're at a break point from the high desert and the great American Southwest. I'm Art Bell. Here I am. Well, we're in the middle of a big one here. David Sirita is my guest. And I've just got a couple of more questions. Of course, I want to know how we brought down the Roswell craft. In fact, if we did, and he claims we did and knows the pilot who brought it down and how, we'll find out in a moment. Good morning. If you're just joining us, my guest is David Sarita, and he is about to present to us a testimony of a man, a 72-year-old man, Boyd Bushman, who was a Lockheed Martin senior research scientist for 20 years, program manager, top secret clearance, former employee of Howard Hughes, Texas Instruments, General Dynamics, and more. The man who designed the Red Eye missile, now the Stinger missile, infrared FLIR systems, and most importantly, he says he reverse engineered anti-gravity and UFO technology. So we're in the middle of a big one here. David, his demeanor when you were there, it was, you know, I have to ask, I mean, solid and sane and all of that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, when you talk physics with somebody like this, like, I mean, he reminded me of Glenn Seaborg in a lot of ways, his demeanor, the way Seaborg was a very tall man. He was, of course, the chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission, authorizing all the nuclear testing not far from you. And, in fact, Howard Hughes used to complain, Seaborg told me, of the shaking of the casinos and tried to get, you know, them to stop testing nuclear weapons. And when I looked at, you know, Boyd Bushman, it's there was a level of brilliance. In fact, Seaborg actually told me this. He told me this before he died. He said that about gravity generators, he said if anyone was developing a gravity generator, you would have something far beyond nuclear fusion. And he said, I don't believe anyone is doing anything like that yet. And Alvar Gyorso, which is Seaborg's personal assistant at Berkeley, told me that Seaborg had access to levels above top secret that were at least in the 30s, from what I remember. Now, if Seaborg was saying that, and he didn't know that anti-gravity was being developed at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which we also get confirmation from Boyd Bushman, in the 1940s and 50s, you know, just after Roswell, then Seaborg didn't have access to this. He didn't have access to this level of information.
All right, let's come back to the Roswell craft for a moment. We were talking about the fact that he claims to know who shot it down and how it was shot down.
Yes. Now, what do you think? Now, you have to remember, this is post-World War II. You know, we just dropped the nuclear bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in August of 1945. So in 1947, July, you know, we're still living in the post-World War II era. So we see an enemy aircraft in our airspace. We don't know that it's not Hitler. We don't know that it's not somebody, you know, one of our allies or one of our enemies. We don't know. There's no radio contact. And the way he describes this thing is it's spherical. But remember, his friend is a Navy doctor who treated the pilot who shot down the Roswell craft. Because as when I play this, you'll understand that. So we have golden testimony from Boyd Bushman and his friend, who today is still a medical doctor and was a Navy doctor, treated the pilot. So the question is, why did he treat the pilot? And I mean, it's really incredible what he's saying here. I mean, it doesn't surprise me. In fact, the fact that an alien craft would be flying in our airspace in a post-World War II environment and not expect to be shot at is quite quite amazing in itself. But then when you think of what could we shoot it down with, because bullets only travel at 1,500 miles an hour. And if you go back to Kenneth Arnold's sighting between Mount Adams and Mount Rainier, he estimated these craft to be doing 1,800 miles an hour, so that's faster than a bullet. So a bullet would never hit anything like that. And then after his sighting, you go to western Idaho. United Airlines pilots see the same chevron-shaped flying saucers in western Idaho. Then in Portland, Oregon, they're seen again on July 4th, Independence Day. They were seen all over the city. So these things are moving all over the country. There is somebody in our airspace that's not supposed to be there. In fact, very recently released FBI FOIA documents on their website, there are numerous accounts of these saucers, even in the eastern seaboard. They're flying all over the country.
All right. All that said, David, how did we shoot it down?
Well, the way we shot it down. Now, when I asked Boyd the question, I said, there's no way it could have been a bullet. He just started laughing. He said, we have all kinds of things out there. But the question is, what did we have in 1943? And the only thing I could find was that when Tesla died on January the 7th, going into the 8th of 1943, very recently released, and I'd never had these when I was director of the Tesla Foundation in L.A., FBI documents clearly state that there was a race to get the Tesla death ray in 1943. In fact, Tesla had a meeting with Roosevelt the next morning, January the 8th, 1943, to talk and discuss the development of the death ray. So, and in fact, the documents state, which I have in my possession, they're kind of like majestic documents on Tesla, that the Tesla death ray was our only possible defense against atomic weapons. And that is what I believe shot it down. The way the death ray works is it fires a ray that disables. It disables all the electronics. That means the spark plugs in the piston engines in the aircraft. I mean, Boyd Bushman is saying that he was flying the fastest aircraft we had at that time, which I think was an F-86 or possibly another experimental aircraft. And it basically shorts out all the electricals. So in the UFO, the same thing, you know, theoretically would happen. You would fire the Tesla death ray at it. In fact, one time, very recently, I just kind of disclosed a little bit of this on a radio show. Someone said that they have a witness who was at Roswell during the time of the crash, and there are certain people that say there were lightning storms certain days of that particular week. Nobody knows the exact day of the Roswell incident. This woman said it was a clear sky, and she saw a bright flash of light in the sky, like a lightning strike, but there were no clouds, and there was no...
No, wait a minute. There were newspaper headlines.
Yeah.
So we can pretty well place the apparent or the alleged day of the crash, can't we?
Well, we have the week. We have July, you know, is it the first, the second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth? I mean, we have the dates of when Jesse Marcel actually came to the site and led.
That's
the,
true. Yep.
We have those dates. So the question is, at the exact time, was there a lightning storm? I've looked very closely on NASA's website of our conventional aircraft receiving lightning strikes, and you know, you get little burn marks on the side of the aircraft, but it doesn't bring them down. So the question is, did lightning bring it down? I mean, when you listen to this testimony, I firmly believe that it was something that was shot down. And the reason I believe that is because when you look on in these FBI documents and you look at the numbers of sightings of these things all over the country in a post-World War II environment, I believe we were tracking these things on radar like crazy. We were following them all over the place. And we didn't get all of them because there were more than one, according to... In fact, on July the 8th, at Edwards Air Force Base, I have copies of testimony from several military officers from that base who saw 9 UFOs, chevron-shaped UFOs, over Edwards Air Force Base. And then there's another document that states, this is on the FBI's website today, it's on their site under FOIA, it's amazing. It's almost the equivalent of what the French just did, except there's no... in fact, it was actually brought to my attention by a fellow researcher, a friend of mine, who said, David, you better look at this. 1,500 pages I have in this file on different levels of, you know, UFO investigation cases under the FBI are there. They're available. And these saucers were all over the country. They were everywhere. So, of course, we were going to chase them and try to shoot them down. And the question was, with what? And I believe, I mean, Boyd just starts laughing. He just says, we have things out there, and he can't identify the weapon for me personally. So when I did my own homework, I really believe the most advanced thing we had back then was the Tesla death ray.
Okay, that comes from you, though.
That comes from me. I mean,
okay.
We can
All
play
right.
this.
Now, with regard to the audio you've got of Boyd Bushman, how long is it?
It's just about 2 minutes.
About 2 minutes. All right,
yeah.
Let's go ahead and play it. I wish I had it and I could play it here, but you've got it, so we'll have to suffer along with that.
I
and I think it's going to work. Go ahead and play it.
Okay.
And possibly
because I knew you were coming, I again got called a friend of mine
mm-hmm.
who was a Navy doctor
mm-hmm.
during the same time period we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Slightly after that, and he all of a sudden was healing a pilot,
mm-hmm.
a person that had been pilot. And he began to tell him a story, and he basically said, one day I was up in one of the faster airplanes that we had,
mm-hmm.
and I had something that was a spherical object that was ahead of me, And I called back and I said, are there any friendlies over here?
Mm-hmm.
He actually took off from a Texas location. He had headed off that way. And
towards New Mexico.
And they said, well, no, there's no friendlies here. And said, not only that, but he's accelerating away from me, and yet I have the fastest airplane that's been designed.
And which at that time was...
And therefore it can't be one of us.
Well, that was,
and they said, you have the weapon on board. It was a new design.
Oh,
and he said, go on ahead and shoot it down. And so he did.
He shot down the Roswell craft. Do you know who did it?
He said, don't give the people my name, nor
and
give
you
the,
know the
nor give, no, you certainly
he shot it down.
He's a very dear the doc.
Wait, what kind of a weapon?
The doctor is a very dear friend of mine.
What kind of...
You got that?
I got it.
Oh, yeah, it goes on and on, and eventually it gets to the point where the pilot actually sees, and I guess in one of his flybys, he lands his plane, and one of the aliens is out running around somewhere, and the other aliens are actually in their custody or in their...
And he's saying all... He says all of this?
He says all of it. I mean, this is all in my new film, From Here to Andromeda, for people who want to see the whole thing. There's so much in this film, not only this. I mean, it's a four-hour film, which is really in four parts, like a series. And I go step by step with Boyd Bushman throughout the film, and one, you know, starting with disclosure, starting with where they took the Roswell craft, we go to another statement on, as he's holding up this document, and this is really significant for me because what he does next is he holds up this document very, very, you know, almost in a very humble way, and he doesn't spell it out for me. He holds it up, and, you know, my girlfriend videotapes the document, and I didn't really recognize what it was until I got home and I started editing. But on this document, which is posted on your website right now for people to see, it says Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, WAPS, and it's a photograph of a saucer that was first test flew in 1959 out of Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and it was nuclear-powered, had a ceiling of 62,000 feet and a range of 3,000 miles, and the contractor is Boeing Convair. Now, when Boyd holds this up, he says, I know the individual who put this together. He actually says that on camera.
And so this was nuclear-powered.
It's nuclear-powered. He actually shows me one step at a time how that nuclear reactor produces anti-gravity, because he does it on a small scale right in front of me, and then they use nuclear power to amplify that particular effect that cancels out gravity. And you think about this. This is 1959. I mean, Senator Barry Goldwater was denied access to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, the hangar where they were keeping the alien bodies in the craft.
Yeah, I know. I've actually heard the audio of that. I presume you have as well.
Yeah, General Curtis LeMay is
right.
The one who denies them access. So if senators can't even get in there, presidents haven't been able even to get access. And here's Boyd Bushman breaking history and confirming by holding up this document and personalizing it.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now.
What's that?
I'm looking at it right now.
Yeah, you're looking at it right now. I mean, that's it. It's the classic saucer shape. What I saw in 1968 in Berkeley, right off the hill from the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, was a silver metallic saucer hovering there. And now I think when he's holding that thing up, I'm going, oh, my God, Boeing Convair. In fact, I even remember my friend and I, when we were looking at the saucer with this crowd of people on the street, pretending we could see USA written on it because we were Star Trek fans, and we thought, no, you can't see anything on there. The sun's just shining off of this shimmering steel. And now I'm looking at this diagram that is personalized. It has a person behind it who was verifying that, yes, this was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and this was the first test flights of the reverse-engineered saucer at Roswell, most likely, from 1959. And he just keeps going from there. It just gets deeper and deeper and deeper, the levels of disclosure. So we have a statement by Ben Rich, once again, the former head of Lockheed Skunk Works, who says there are two types of UFOs, ours and theirs. Now, That is very confirmed by Boyd Bushman. It's very
all right. And by the way, everybody, if you go to the website, not only can you see this diagram, but if you go down below that, there is a photograph of Boyd Bushman, who looks quite distinguished. And so that's the man, and that's the diagram. Think what you will. There it is. Diameter 40 feet, maximum speed, it's hard to read for me, Mach 1.2, is that correct?
Yeah, Mach 1.2 with a question mark.
Power plant, nuclear reactor, range 3,000 miles, crew of one, ceiling of 62,000 feet, first flight, was that 1959 in the USA?
1959.
Contractor Boeing Convair, wow.
Yeah.
That certainly would explain a lot, wouldn't it?
It explains so much. And the next thing he does is after he demonstrates anti-gravity and how he discovered it personally and reverse engineered it, he shows me this giant nuclear reactor that is a mock-up amplified version of his mini experiment that he does in front of me with a huge crane being lowered into a classified aircraft. And if you, when I zoom in, and I do this in the film, I zoom in once again on the corner where all the data is on the document, and it says Convair. And that was in Texas, where that location, where that was actually being.
Is there any way at all, I know it's a silly question, to verify the authenticity of the document?
Well, I've tried my best to do that. There are no documents like this in existence anywhere in ufology. When I look at all of you know, through Ryan Wood's book, Majestic Eyes Only, all of the documents they have, I've looked at numerous documents. In fact, there are other documents that are available that show kind of a disc shape jet engine or jet propulsion engine craft, but those are not nuclear powered. Now, if we consider even the idea of a nuclear reactor producing propulsion or lift, NASA doesn't use nuclear propulsion with the space shuttle. We only use it with certain satellites today. In fact, nuclear propulsion is something that didn't really, you're talking the 1950s here.
I wasn't even aware they were using nuclear power for propulsion per se. I know they use it for power, once something's in orbit on occasion, right? Or in some deep space probes, we've certainly used it for power.
Yeah, we use it for power for what are called ion propulsion drives. And ion propulsion drives essentially electrostatically charge propellant mass fuel, very small amounts of it, to give it more thrust. So you get more power. You can go a lot faster. So we have satellites that can do 35 or 40,000 miles an hour, you know, right up there with meteorites. But we don't have anything to date that, you know, under the description of nuclear propulsion that, you know, starts on the ground and just goes lifting up in the air. I mean, that just doesn't exist. I mean, our satellites take off, I mean, in the payload bay on the space shuttle, they're basically let them go up in the earth, you know, above the atmosphere. We don't have anything that takes off from the ground. Now, I researched EG&G. EG&G was one of the top defense contractors in the country. In fact, when I did bomb detection, we did some business with them. And on their website, when I was working there in 1987, they boasted that they had at the nuclear test site, Nevada test site, nuclear test site rocket station at the Nevada nuclear test site, they had successful nuclear propulsion system tests in 1958 and 1968. There were two tests that they did, and they said they were successful. So, and I thought, what are nuclear propulsion system tests, you know, on ground level? What is that? And I asked Stanton Friedman those kind of questions, and he, you know, he has some information in that area. But as far as how it actually works, how the anti-gravity is working, the nuclear energy part is not the answer itself. It's what you use the nuclear energy for. What is element 115, Bob Lazar's, you know, sacred element 115? How is it used? How does it produce the anti-gravity? And that's
David, hold tight. We're right up against a break. There's so much more to do. Remarkable stuff. David Sarita is my guest. I'm Art Bell. We'll be back. Here I am. David Sarita is my guest. He is a remarkable guy who's interviewing a remarkable guy, Boyd Bushman. I suggest you all cruise on up to the website, coasttocoastam.com, and take a look at the documents that are there, the document that is there, Certainly, if this craft really was flown by the United States, it would explain an awful lot of sightings. An awful lot of sightings that we had then and now, wouldn't it? My God, it's incredible. And I want to find out a little more about how David got on to Mr. Bushman. More of all this in a moment. All right, David, I'd like to go back and find out, if I can, how you got on to Boyd Bushman.
Okay, well, that I mentioned that briefly, but John Hutchison, Canadian scientist John Hutchison.
I know him well, yeah.
You know him well, he's been on your show. John and I are friends. John actually said, David, you want to interview Boyd Bushman. And he's at Lockheed, and I just said, okay. And then I started writing Boyd letters, and, you know, about 8 months ago or so, and we started getting into these email conversations. We spoke on the phone, and it was just so brilliant. I love speaking to elderly, you know, knowledgeable individuals, whether they're scientists
or
explorers, because it's kind of like when you think of the Native Indian tradition, they pass down their teachings to the next generation orally, you know, through word of mouth. And I felt like he was doing that. I felt like, you know, when I finally met Boyd, it was like he decided to, you know, pick me because I have been diligently working in these fields for many years, for decades actually. And I was close. I mean, my schematics and in fact, I started having dreams after the UFO I saw in 1968. I started having dreams about the propulsion system. And it's so close when you finally find out how anti-gravity works. It's amazing. There are a lot of kids. In fact, in my film From Here to Andromeda, I interviewed these four or five kids in this family, and they claimed they saw a UFO in the eye of Hurricane Katrina while they were living in Florida, and you know, when it was coming over the eye. And one of the girls started doing this thing with her hands, you know, showing me how the lights or the waves in the UFO were moving in a particular field pattern. And it's like they were identical to my dreams. They're identical to what is happening in crop circles. Crop circles have a language for, you know, particle physicists who look at photographs and bubble chambers of the trails that subatomic particles leave. That's an actual language that I'm very familiar with. So when you're looking at these kind of wave patterns, you can understand what they mean. And here was this girl, and she must be like 11 years old, doing the same thing with her hands that I saw in my dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And
let's come back for a second to Mr. Bushman. Can you sort of tick off for me what his first person claims are?
Well, his patents. If you go down the list on his patents, I mean, he's got...
No, not so much his patents, David. But his claims with regard... we've already heard what he says about Roswell and about the craft that was, he says, shot down. But again, that's through another individual.
Right.
When I say first person claims, anti-gravity, that's his, correct?
That's his, yes. And how it works is very specifically is his work. And
all right, and he claims that this technology was back engineered from the Roswell craft or other craft.
I think it's more than the Roswell craft. I mean, when we get into Roswell with him, you know, on camera, and you start asking him, what is his access and what was involved in the steps and the procedures towards not just disclosure, but also to, you know, actually finding out how these craft work. He makes that statement that he can only show me from a white world form information from that form. And John Hutchison, I mean, these guys study everybody. I mean, Lockheed Martin, I mean, you look at all of our top defense contractors, believe me, they study everybody. And if John Hutchison had something that was beyond them, he would have been hired by now. But they're way ahead of him. They're interested in him, and they're probably interested in why and how Hutchison stumbled upon anti-gravity. And sometimes the Hutchison effect works, and other times it doesn't. So the question is why. And then there are other researchers, you know, people like Bob Lazar that were of great interest to Boyd Bushman. And, you know, there are many people. But when you get into the black area with him, he suddenly, I mean, he loses his sense of humor and he locks up, and you can tell you're not going to get any further. But personally, he personally demonstrates the different phases that lead to anti-gravity right in front of me and gives me enough information with what I already know that I can do it myself. In fact,
all right, well, what exactly did he demonstrate for you, and what did you capture on film?
Okay, the first thing is a very simple experiment. It's this little thing called a celt, or a rattleback, if you look it up on Wikipedia. They were found in ancient Egypt and in England, in early explorers in England found these things. And essentially what they are, they look like an ark or a canoe that you spin on your table. I have one. In fact, I spin it. I should make a little video of this and put it on the Internet. And what he says is, according to Newton, you know, Galileo, Newtonian, Einstein's physics, once you set something in motion, it tends to remain in motion unless it's acted on by an outside force. And all forces are equal in opposite directions. So your positive and negative forces in your atom, this is what physicists believe today, cancel each other out to a big fat zero. And I've always believed that wasn't true. I've always believed there's something called differentials. Now, when you spin this thing counterclockwise, it spins very freely. When you spin it clockwise, it starts to vibrate and rattles back and wants to go back counterclockwise. Now, he says,
wait a minute, David. If you start something in motion, it does not continue in motion indefinitely.
Unless it's acted upon by an outside force. And the outside force is called inertia. Inertia is...
Okay.
Okay. So now when you spin this thing clockwise, it starts to vibrate and then goes back counterclockwise all by itself. And what that tells us is that clockwise and anticlockwise are not equal. The counterclockwise force is slightly stronger than the clockwise force. And those forces are around us all the time. And it's very similar to gravity and the expansion force in the universe. They're not equal. One of them is slightly stronger than the other. The entire universe is made up of atomic structures that are positive and negative charge. They're all in this state of duality. Traditionally, most particle physicists have believed that those two forces, that the force of the electron cancels out the proton and to an absolute zero. And that is not true. Now, what are called differentials is the difference or leftover force between those two forces. Differentials open up another dimension of force, another dimension of energy. So that's the first experiment he does in front of me. Then what he does is he does something really quite amazing, is he takes magnets that are north-north. You know what happens if you take two magnets and you push them together north-north and they start to repel?
Yes.
Okay, very simple, right? Well, what he decides to do, he believes that the gravity and magnetism and electromagnetism may be related to each other. And in fact, at the time of the Big Bang, at this enormous temperature of the Big Bang, all of the forces were one. They were all together. They were kind of melded together. And as the universe cooled over billions of years, the forces separated. So he thinks that they are related. So what Boyd does, and he actually holds up a document for what I'm about to say, is he takes a north-north magnet, $5,000 a piece, super magnets, and he drills a hole in the center of them, and he bolts them down on a shaft, so they're forcing together so hard, he says they produce a field. Remember, these are $5,000 magnets, which you've got to spend a lot of money on if you want to do this. And he bolts them down, and he wraps them in this kind of plaster to make it look like a rock, right? And he measures this field 3 feet wide on all sides of this thing. Then he goes up, just like Galileo, you know, back in the early days in Italy when he drops the falling bodies off the Leaning Tower of Pisa. And then according to Galileo, in fact, this was done on Apollo 15 on the moon, if you drop a feather and a hammer, it doesn't matter how much two different objects weigh, they fall at the same speed towards the Earth. They both have different energies, but they fall at the same velocity. He goes up to a tower in Lockheed, and he actually holds this document up stating the date and time when he did this test, and he takes an ordinary rock that looks just like the rock that has the opposing field $5,000 supermagnets in it. He drops them both 9 times, and he gets these guys that he said are uneducated and have no knowledge of Galileo, and he tells them to hand him the rock that lands first. Every single time, they hand him the rock that has no opposing field magnets in it. So his opposing field magnets take longer to hit the ground than its neighbor. So what that demonstrates, in fact, that is groundbreaking in itself. That is
very interesting.
That's very interesting. So it's a 59-foot tower. In fact, I just emailed Lex the actual document that he holds up on your webmaster, so he should put it up on your site. And he does it 9 times, and it cancels out a... So I said, Boyd, if you can cancel out even a percentage of gravity, even a percentage of it, the amount of fuel you would need for the space shuttle to go into orbit would be much less, right? Well, what happens when you amplify that effect? And what does, if you look at north-north, the two north sides of a magnet or south-south, what does that look like as a waveform? It's really interesting here because
how much difference was there in when they hit the ground, and are we sure that they left at the same time?
Oh yeah, no, they left at the same time. I mean, there's no way a guy like Boyd Bushman would drop them at different times. I mean, it would be very precise, 9 times in a row to be sure. It just keeps happening. Now
and then, how much difference, just out of curiosity, between when they hit the ground?
I didn't get that information. I actually, you know, was very curious of that information myself because, you know, 59 feet is not very far, but neither is the Leaning Tower of Pisa very high. So now what's important next is what he shows me next consecutively in the interview is this nuclear-powered amplified version of that experiment being lowered by this huge crane into the belly of a classified aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
So that now what happens is, if you apply more energy in the opposing field, you're going to cancel out more of gravity. You know,
right.
You see, so that's what they started doing. That was the beginning of canceling out gravity, was using nuclear propulsion. Now let's look what happens, because the Betty Cash case in Texas, this woman Betty Cash and her son and her mother, they see these Army helicopters chasing a flying saucer, or what we call a UFO, that is blazing red hot and glowing like the sun, and this thing is kind of wobbling along. And where is it happening? It's happening in Texas. And that is exactly where Lockheed's headquarters is. In fact, Lockheed, when I was there just about a month ago in the newspaper, you know, in the local newspaper, they were showing how much money all the different defense contractors got in the last year, and I think Lockheed was around $27 billion. They were the cream of the crop. They were way beyond Boeing. And, of course, Lockheed Skunk Works is where all the black projects are done. So what he's showing me is that if you amplify this effect, I mean, two $5,000 magnets may only cancel out, who knows, 10% or 20% of gravity. I don't know the exact amount, and I can get that information. But if you amplify that, then it starts to get more and more interesting. If you can cancel out 50% and then 100%, then once you cancel out 100% of gravity and inertia, tiny thrusters of energy, ion thrusters, electric ion thrusters, will send you thousands of miles an hour.
Sure, you'd be able to go to orbit without even breaking a sweat.
Without even and you look at the shuttle program, the Apollo program, you know, and you think, if these guys were doing this in the 1950s, nuclear propulsion, this is what I believe the true use of element 115 is. You take element 115 and you put it in opposing fields, electromagnets, not just, you know, magnetized magnets as we use. We use ferrous or iron material, and we, you know, we magnetize metal and turn it into an actual magnet. But if you use nuclear-powered electromagnets, essentially what electromagnets look like is they're ferrous material wrapped with a Tesla coil, right? The more windings, the stronger the field gets. So what happens is if you really know what that looks like in a waveform, if you take a clockwise spinning electromagnet coil and you cut it in half and you look at and you turn it on its side, one of them will look like it's going clockwise and one of them will look like it's going anticlockwise. Because what you're doing is you're taking two north-north and you're slamming them together in it to produce a field that Boyd Bushman says cancels out, that gravity no longer recognizes that object anymore because of what you've done to the field. Now, I did some research today on NASA's very own website, and I found something. I started looking up Galileo and, you know, falling bodies, tests on falling bodies. And I found some admittance there that there were deviations depending on, not as detailed as Boyd Bushman is giving, but there are some deviations on the tests on falling bodies that are being done today. So it is not 100% flawless. You know, Galileo and Newton, and get Newton relying on Galileo's test, we have a discrepancy there. So that is as much as he's admitting on the first level of the test, but then he's personalizing it and showing me on an amplified scale that that's what's going into the belly of these craft. Now, what I discovered When you convert energy into electromagnetism, which is essentially radio photons at that point, which is what Tesla coils do, you're taking mass and converting it into light, and then you can convert light back into mass again through Einstein's photoelectric effect. Essentially, what I discovered was that you guys are throwing all of this energy away in the field, and if you could recapture it, recycle the radio photons, you could do the same thing with a lot less energy. And I actually, you know, gave Boyd Bush and my schematics, my drawings of how that would actually work, and they're actually looking at that. So I believe one of the reasons we are not seeing anti-gravity nuclear-powered 100%, you know, gravity-canceled craft flying around in our airlines and in the war in Iraq is because they're highly radioactive. I mean, they're using a lot of nuclear energy to produce the effect. But somebody has figured out how to do it with a lot less energy. Because one of the things Boyd told me was that when they examined the Roswell craft, they didn't find any electricity or requirements for such a thing. So the only way I can answer that, I mean, no generator, no requirements for electricity, a translucent material that you can actually see through. I mean, the only way you can answer that question is if you can cancel out your mass gravity equivalent to zero, and you put that in Einstein's formula, if your mass is zero and energy is equal to mass times the speed of light squared, what is zero times the speed of light squared? Zero. So how much energy does it take to go to the speed of light squared? Zero. So that would mean you don't need a power source. Once you have transformed your mass and you can cancel out gravity, maybe you don't even need a power source. Maybe at that point consciousness or thought, which is a very low amplitude, very weak waveform, is enough to tell it to move left or right or do whatever. I don't know at that point. But I do know that if once you cancel out your mass gravity down to zero, it's not about energy anymore. It's not even about an energy source. And that's where Boyd starts to get into force number 7, 8, and 9, which are the higher forces. In the very end of my interview with him, I asked him point blank, and remember, Ben Rich, who was former head of Lockheed Skunk Works, said that we now have the technology to go to the stars. We now have that.
Well, if that's true, David, then we now have the technology to begin to power our needs here on Earth without doing what we're doing to the Earth, and that's about the only way we're going to save our own butts.
Exactly, and I think that's why he's giving this out, because like we said in the beginning of the interview, if you can cancel out even 50% of the weight and gravity relationship of a motor vehicle, electric cars can go with, you know, 500, 600 miles on a single charge. So, and what does that energy cost? According to the article I read in Popular Mechanics or Popular Science on the ZapX, $3.50 right now on electricity will take you 350 miles. If you can double that, $1.50 is going to take you 350 miles. So energy isn't going to be a commodity in the future.
Did Mr. Bushman point you toward anybody who can corroborate what he said?
Well, yes, because the experiments he does right in front of me, the next experiment he does right in front of me, and these get really interesting. He takes a Tesla coil, which is
all right, hold okay. It right there, because we're going to find out about that experiment, also something, apparent knowledge about some sort of mysterious purple wave that struck the space shuttle Columbia. All of that with David Sirita coming up in a moment. Yeah, that's right. We still have a moment. What am I talking about? There is something regarding the space shuttle Columbia, right, David?
Yeah, that's in my film as well. I've really gone into this in a very deep level.
All right, but it's going to be in your interview as well tonight, now.
Yeah, we can talk about it, yeah.
How did you become is this also something he told you about?
Actually, when I brought that subject up to him, he got very disturbed, and I didn't want to ruin the rest of my interview. He got very upset.
He got very disturbed, as in he had knowledge about it, or
it looked like he didn't have knowledge of that. But I can tell you this, I mean, just as a cameo into that subject, I interviewed an investment banker named George Mosman, whom with his attorney in Dallas, Texas, that day the shuttle went down, had his Zeiss binoculars, and he saw two metallic flying saucers.
All right, hold it right there. We'll be right back. Here indeed I am. David Sirita is my guest. He's got some blockbuster stuff to be sure. Listen to me, everybody. Those are the numbers. They're there for a reason. If you've got a question about anything you've heard thus far, I've got David Sarita. So in a moment, we'll start taking calls and questions from all of you. This is Coast to Coast AM. Well, all right, David, I want to be very careful here. You know, it says on the paper that we all get when we do interviews, as a last question or last talking point, let's talk about why and what you know about the mysterious purple wave that struck the space shuttle Columbia. Now, that's sensitive stuff. That's going to upset a lot of Americans. And I wanted to first be clear about whether it actually came from your contact, came from him or came from you, or where it came from, whether it's been confirmed or whatever.
Actually, after the show we did on Christmas Eve, I think it was, one of your listeners actually sent me all five photographs that were taken by the British astronomer who was noted in the San Francisco Chronicle. There was the article in the San Francisco Chronicle that stated that a purple corkscrewing wave struck the space shuttle just moments before we lost contact with the space shuttle, minutes before, and that this British astronomer took five photographs with a Nikon 800 digital camera, and each exposure is 4 to 6 seconds long. Somebody sent me all five of the photographs. I am not legally allowed to put the photographs in my film, but because they're so simple, legally I'm allowed to do artistic renderings. NASA never disclosed the name of the individual who took the photographs, but he reveals himself when somebody accidentally or through NASA just put his photographs on the Internet, and he demanded they take them down. And, of course, he reveals his identity, and his name is Dr. Peter Goldie. He's actually a head of a philosophy chair in England. And he's the one who took the photographs. So we know from the San Francisco Chronicle that this actually happened, that these photographs were taken. Without disclosing the photographs to the American public, the Chronicle stated that, the shuttle was struck by something called super lightning. Now, if anybody knows anything about lightning and knows that lightning reaches its target virtually almost instantaneously, and it can only flash for about, in fact, the longest lightning strikes I test in my editing bay, in my video editing bay, are about 1/3 of a second. That is the longest strike I have in New Mexico from the ground to a cloud. Most of them are about 1/10 of a second or less on an actual video frame, which means a video camera pulses at 30 frames per second, and on top of that you have exposure, or you could have 1/1000th of a second on each of those 30 frames, or 1/4 of a second, for example. So there's no way a lightning strike could exist over the different photographs that Peter Goldie took. And when we actually look at his actual photographs, whatever this purple corkscrewing wave is, it's coming from above. The shuttle is doing it about 12,500 miles an hour, which is about Mach 18. And this thing doesn't strike it instantaneously. It seems to aim straight at it, and it kind of spirals towards it. And then when it hits the point that it thought the shuttle was at its time of launch, or whatever this thing is, it course corrects at 90 degrees. And it's probably doing 15 or 16 or possibly 20,000 miles an hour. It course corrects at that speed at 90 degrees and chases after the shuttle. That's in photograph number two. And in photograph number three, remember, these are 4 to 6 second exposures. There's no way a lightning strike can show up in any more than one exposure on a still frame, on a digital camera or on a film point. So there's no way this is lightning. And if it was lightning, it would have struck its target instantaneously in one frame. So, because, you know, he has to repress the shutter on his tripod and take another picture, 4 to 6 seconds long. The sun hasn't yet risen yet. It's 5:53 a.m. San Francisco time, which is where he's taking the photograph. And on the third photograph, you can clearly see this purplish corkscrewing wave has struck the shuttle. And the shuttle is just a bright white line preceding this exact moment, because it's streaking by over 4 to 6 seconds. There's no camera movement because he's on a tripod, so you get this kind of pure white line going from left to right in the frame. And then in the frame where you see that it struck the shuttle, the shuttle gets brighter. It's like it flares up, but it doesn't explode. And this alleged lightning strike no longer goes anywhere else. It's reached its target. It's delivered its energy or whatever it's done. It doesn't look anything like a lightning strike to me. And then in the fourth and fifth photographs, there's no evidence of any fraying. It doesn't, you know, go in any other direction. So it's definitely has actually struck the shuttle. The shuttle's a lot brighter. And then just minutes later is when the last transmission from the space shuttle, you know, occurs. So what we have here is what is so interesting about this is that it's moving at a velocity. So it's not behaving like an electromagnetic pulse weapon. It's not an EMP weapon, which is just a big flash anyway. It's not a missile because most of our missiles don't go anywhere near that fast. They go, you know, maybe Mach 3 or 4 tops, including the Stinger and the Sidewinder and anti-tank missiles. I've gone down the list of all of our missiles. The only missiles that can go 18,000 miles an hour are the ICBM family, and those are your nuclear missiles. And there's no way a nuclear missile was launched at our space shuttle. So that's out of the question. So the question is, what is it? And when I finished this segment, it was really kind of amazing. When I finished editing this segment, I'm not saying I know what it is, and it definitely doesn't look like a Tesla death ray. That's for darn sure, because that would strike its target almost instantaneously. It would not have to course correct and, you know, chase after the thing. But
all right, David, you've given us so much information across so much territory here. I want to allow some of the audience to ask you questions. Mm-hmm. All right? Is that all right, David?
Sure, yeah, let's go.
All right, good. All right, let's do it. Andy, you're in Florida. You're on the air with David Cerita. Hi.
Well, hi, Art. Hi, David. I've been listening to you for 20 years, by the way. I love your show.
Thank you.
To say that. I first time called it. I wanted to confirm, I was really shocked when David talked about nuclear-powered flying saucers. In 1976, I had finished my, I had just entered the University of Colorado, and my major was physics, and I flew on an airplane, Swiss Air flight, from New York City to Zurich, Switzerland. The man next to me saw that I was reading a physics book, and he opened his briefcase, and he showed me diagrams of a flying saucer, and showed me photographs of a flying saucer that he said he helped develop. And he said he was on this flight because the government was deporting him from the United States back over to Europe, that he had been captured during the war. And the interesting thing about his flying saucer was that it was nuclear powered.
Wow.
And he said that was one of the problems with the general public wouldn't be able to deal with flying objects around that were nuclear powered. But he did tell me that it would go supersonic. It was over Mach 1. And he said it could lift a payload, hover and lift a payload larger than the sky cranes of those days.
All right. Have you seen the documents, caller, that are up on Coast to Coast right now?
No, I haven't. I just now, I'm a truck driver. Just now stopped. I haven't had a chance to look and see those. But I did want to. Can I give the guy's name that was sitting next to me? It might be.
No. I would very much prefer you do not do that.
Okay.
But email it to me.
What's that?
You can email it to me.
Okay. Yeah, I'd like to email his name. He said he had a company in California, and that he had owned this company, and that the government had gone in and taken all of his research materials and all of his prototypes and all of that stuff. And shipped him back out. He was also said that he was good friends with the Einstein family. So there should be some trail or paper trail behind it. But very interesting stuff. I just had to let somebody know that.
All right. Well, that is interesting. And I'll tell you what. Listen very carefully because I'm going to let David give out his email address
right.
So that you can send this to him. David.
All right. I will.
Go ahead. It's very simple. It's just David Cerita, Cereda, @hotmail.com.
David Cerita @hotmail.com. That's easy enough.
Yeah.
Is this how many individuals like this one have you run into, David, who also make similar claims?
Well, actually, I just got an email. I just checked my emails during the break, and there is another individual who has a very similar story, actually in California, describing that he accidentally stumbled upon these documents when he was working for a particular contractor, and it's a very similar story. But another thing, Michael Schratt, who's another UFO researcher, he has documentation from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base of a scientist who personally reverse-engineered and built a nuclear-powered saucer. And we're trying to confirm if it's the same name or friend of Boyd Bushman's who designed this particular one, or who actually, was one of the senior scientists on this project. Now, we know from from, you know, the Majestic documents that, of course, who would, once you have all these generals, you know, sequestering the Roswell craft and other crash retrievals, who do they bring in? They bring in scientists, because scientists are the only ones who can understand how these things work. And that is what Boyd Bushman is. He's a senior scientist. He is definitely, in my opinion, one of the most brilliant scientists, probably the most brilliant scientist I've ever met in my life.
Does he claim that he's had hands-on with alien craft?
I couldn't get that out of him, no. I couldn't get those exact words, but I think I can deduct that from the conversation. I think maybe I'll get that on camera before he dies. He's 73. He has, you know, diabetes. I don't know how much longer he's going to be around, but I think maybe I will eventually get to that point. I do believe he understands, and I asked him the question, do you think we will survive as a species on this planet? And he gave me the most incredible answer. He said, the first question is there life? Are we alive? And are we passionate about life? And those who are alive, he believes you're not alive until you found your life's passion. And he said, those who are alive are going to figure out how to escape this planet and find another one. So I think he believes that we are not going to survive, and that is why he's giving us anti-gravity, enough information that we can engineer it and start canceling out gravity and saving a lot of energy and eventually...
All right, David. All right, here comes Bill from Long Island, New York. You're on with David Sarita.
Mr. Sarita, John... what's his name? Plane manufacturer, Learjet, John.
Yeah, yeah, John Lear. Yeah,
yeah. He maintained that we had a second, program with going to the moon and stuff. And this Mr. Bushman's revelations sort of give credibility to that claim by Mr. Lear.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to hear your comments on that, whether you believe, does this put Mr. Bushman in any kind of danger?
I don't think it puts him or me in any kind of danger, and here's why I believe that. I believe, just like the telephone, if you think of the Bell curve, Alexander Graham Bell, you know, by the time these scientists have perfected and re-perfected this type of technology in a research lab, and they've moved on to things that are much more, you know, advanced of this. And I think, you know, Boyd is pointing to the 7th, 8th, and 9th force, and that the 6th is anti-gravity. If we've had this since the 1950s, then it's time that it gets out, because humanity can benefit from this. We can solve zero-point energy and global warming with this knowledge. We can move on to a higher level of civilization, and I think he wants that for the world. The only people who are going to be threatened by it are oil companies that are going to go out of business anyway, because the oil...
Well, that's a big threat. And,
that is a big threat.
It is important in this interview, David, that we separate what Mr. Bushman believes or what his opinion is, mm-hmm. and for that matter, yours, from what he's claiming as actual fact, hands-on,
right.
I know this to be true kind of actual fact. And what he said certainly would back up what John Lear has said, and
definitely. I've met John Lear, and John Lear told me that most of the UFOs we see are ours, and there are alien craft, but they're much more rare. And I think I believe that at this point.
Mm-hmm. Well, it would also back a lot of what Lazar has said.
Absolutely. I believe, after talking to Mr. Bushman, that Bob Lazar is for real. He had true access. But I don't think he's a know-it-all. I don't think he understands how these things work. In fact, Lazar...
Well, he never... Now, wait a minute.
Yeah.
He never claimed to understand exactly how they work.
Yeah,
he,
I know.
His claims were quite limited, mm-hmm. although he certainly claimed hands-on. He claimed...
yeah.
And by the way, his claims have always been very consistent. They've never been enlarged on. As you do interviews with Bob Lazar, you get the same story every time.
Where is he today? That's what I want to know.
Oh, I think he's over the hill in Las Vegas. First time caller, or maybe not. Maybe in New Mexico. I don't know where he is right now. Ray in Indiana, you're on with David Sarita.
Hey, Art. Hey, Dave. He kind of answered the question. My question was, why is this technology being used right now? And I wouldn't question it if I haven't, you know. I did see something, and of all dates, April 1st, kind of sort of that technology. It's kind of weird up in the air. And I wouldn't have said anything if I wouldn't have seen it twice. I saw it twice, and it was kind of weird. It's kind of weird. I could see it with my sunglasses, and once I took off my sunglasses, I couldn't see it. And I was comparing it to a jet, you know, an airplane coming from the west, and I could see that ball. It was just a chrome ball up in the air, and then all of a sudden it takes off to the east.
Okay, so you're telling us about a sighting you had. Do you have any questions, Ray, for David?
Yeah, why that technology is not being used if it's out there? You know, I saw it myself, and why?
Millions of Americans have had similar sightings, and it is a very good question, David. If you have the answer to it,
well,
if all of this technology exists, where is it in our moment of need? And certainly, the moment of need arrived some time ago.
Well, like I said before, I don't think we have a need to be flying around anti-gravity craft as civilians, but I think there are certain uses to anti-gravity, as I mentioned before. If you can reduce the weight of a vehicle in relation to gravity, it takes way less energy to move it around, and we can get off foreign oil and a steady curve towards sustainability. So
then why is it not public?
It is. I mean, in my film, literally, step by step, one small experiment after another, you can figure out how to do this. I really believe that Boyd Bishman has given us the answer in From Here to Andromeda. If you look at it, if engineers look at it, and I think I understand it, I can, you know, duplicate it. It's not
that complicated. You say here, you've heard that there's a plan underway to release some, if not all, of this material in the near future. What do you know about that?
Well, they'll never release all of it when you consider the bell curve. They're not going to give us, because I asked Boyd this at the very end. I didn't get to say this yet, but I said, could we get to Andromeda, 2.2 million light years away from here, and that's the name of my film, on the 7th or 8th or 9th force? And he said, absolutely. There was no question in his mind at the end, absolutely. And for a man with his background to state that, not modestly, absolutely, is remarkable. And when you consider that, if we're already, as Ben Rich states, you know, we already have the technology to go to the stars, not the planets, but the stars, then anti-gravity is just the tip of the iceberg. It's enough to transform humanity and save the planet, yes, but it's not the whole enchilada. I mean, there's a lot more. And I don't believe they're going to give us all that yet.
Yeah, but it'll do for now. Kimberly in Portland, Oregon, you're on with David.
Hi, David. My question is specifically about the difference between the alien craft and the craft that we've manufactured. You said a while back that Mr. Bushman specified that, you know, there are their crafts and then there are our crafts. And I actually had a sighting of a triangle craft, and they seem to be a little less prevalent, but maybe increasing here recently. But I'm wondering, did he specify anything about, you know, the triangle crafts in general, or about the difference that generally the alien crafts tend to be a certain shape, or do you know anything about that in particular?
Was actually, the statement was by Ben Rich, who was the former head of Lockheed Skunk Works, who said there's their craft and there's ours. Boyd Bushman is very explicit in detailing that, yes, there are. He does actually state that in the interview, that there are alien craft that are actually here, and then there are ours. So, yes, the triangles, when you think of a case like the Phoenix Lights, you know, a mile-wide triangle, I find it hard to believe that that's one of ours. Also, just prior to the Phoenix Lights, one of my witnesses in my film, George Mosman, and his sons were camping in the Anza-Borrega State Park on the Mexico-California border, and they saw an equal-sized mothership in 1995, and they made drawings of it. So I don't believe those are ours, but maybe I'm wrong. I mean, what do I know?
All right, David. Apparently, you know quite a bit. David Sirita is my guest. Top of the hour. We're going to continue taking calls for David Sirita into the next hour. I'm Art Bell. Here I am. My guest is David Sirita, and I don't want to discourage anybody from giving us sightings. Well, maybe in a way I do. We all know that millions of Americans have had sightings of the kind of craft that we're talking about tonight. But If it's possible, I'd like you to confine your questions for David to that which he said, or Mr. Bushman has said, or the whole concept that we're talking about, so that we don't turn it into a sightings program. We all, in fact, I'm one of you. I've had two of what I would call major sightings. At any rate, this is fairly startling material, to be sure. And also, I'm going to be asking David in a moment whether any of the other disclosure community, any of the other people in the disclosure community, have yet interviewed Mr. Bushman. And if not, I would imagine after this program, they'll be hot on his trail. More in a moment. All right, David, I'd like to ask if Mr. Bushman has done any one-on-one interviews on programs like this, or whether he's talked to any other disclosure folks.
I don't believe he's ever talked to anybody publicly yet. The interview he gave me was about almost an hour and 40 minutes of videotape, so mm-hmm. I've used very valuable segments in my film, but there's a lot more in there. In fact, there's some stuff that's really just over the top, shocking, that he's giving me. But he, you know, in the whole time I've known him, he hasn't told me anything over the phone, and on his emails are very brief. It's not until I went to meet him in person that he disclosed everything. So,
well, you say over the top, so over the top, shocking that you didn't necessarily even include it in the film. Now, was that because it was too shocking or too unbelievable?
Well,
as
no,
to
there's
invalidate?
One thing. It took me a while to decide to put this in the film because it is so shocking. It's something that's going to happen on our planet that they all, you know, all these, you know, scientists know about, and they know when this thing is going to happen. And it's one of the reasons I believe he gave us anti-gravity. He wants us to have this. There's enough information here that engineers could go to work, and this could be common knowledge, this anti-gravity stuff. At least, like I said, canceling out a percentage of gravity would be. But the event that he talks about, and I'm trying to get confirmation on this, is, and this is in the film, he says that there is an asteroid, or he calls it a rock, that's going to hit us. And they know when it's going to hit us, and he gives us the date. It's about 2039. It's a long ways off. And it's not like the rock that ended the dinosaurs, but it's a fair-sized rock, and he said it will be many, many megatons of nuclear, you know, equivalency when it hits. And they know where roughly it's going to hit.
Well, with everything else that's going on this planet right now, we might as well bring on a rock.
We may as well bring on a rock. But, you know, by then, he does state that we may have the ability to divert it at that point. We may actually have the technology, and we probably already do, if everything else that Ben Rich is stating about Lockheed is correct, then we may already have the technology to divert it. But it's a fair-sized rock. He showed us a picture of it on camera, and it's definitely nothing small. And, you know, probably, I said, would it be bigger than Tunguska? And he just said many, many megatons of nuclear equivalency. So, you know, maybe if it hits, it could end. If you look at, you know, if for people who believe in the Book of Revelation, there is a section in there that talks about a star that hits the Earth, and I think it's called the Star of Wormwood or something like that. And
Wormwood, yes.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, maybe
Mark in Philadelphia, you're on with David.
How are you guys? I will say, just on that last point, I can't imagine if it's that far out that we won't either ourselves be out there, or even more likely that the aliens aren't already sort of protecting the Earth from most incomings like that anyway. So, you know, I'll be surprised if that was to come in. But Mr. Bushman's patents online are fascinating. I've looked up and seen a bunch of different stuff, including really far out stuff like digital transmission of information through the output in the back of exhaust of jets.
Yeah, the exhaust plume detection.
Radiation-based, really wild, digital-based sort of exhaust plume, and then decoding on the other end so you can, you know, secretly download the information while, you know, the U2's flying or whatever, which is fascinating stuff. I can't believe some of this stuff is out there when you start reading this material. I don't know why it wouldn't be kept black. But in any case,
yeah, it's all in the U.S. Patent Office. What's great about this guy is he's got a paper trail. You know,
yeah,
you
can... he has fascinating stuff online. I will say there's some other material now, some other interviews, but I'll be interested to see if what you have will hopefully be a more heavily or significantly weighted object than the coil that's shown in the levitation videos and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, have you – question number one would be, is there a why aren't you guys putting together some type of experiment? You know, it sounds like Tesla, Ed Leeds Gown, and all this related stuff, you know, but on a larger scale. Why aren't you guys putting together maybe some more significantly weighted objects to show that on?
Well, that's where this all goes next. I mean,
okay.
the knowledge is I'm sorry,
I didn't mean to cut you off. I know there's not a lot of time. I assume that you know, that's what goes on at all of our bases, and why, which leads to my second question or point, which would be a different answer to the question of why the general public wouldn't be made privy to the so-called anti-gravity, this type of information. I mean, the few who really pull the strings, you know, according to the significant information that's been out there that any of us can read, you know, would consider it the ultimate state secret and would want the U.S.'s adversaries to have at least a delay in terms of the time that they get it, just like happened with the Manhattan Project.
Those are great questions. I mean, I used to be a small defense contractor. I was president of High Energy Micro Devices, bomb detection. And the way things work with the military is when you get a contract, if it's useful for the military, they do an acquisition. The Undersecretary of Defense for Acquisition and Technology puts out a call for proposals to either build or deliver existing technology. Now, if there's no need for an acquisition in their department, then they won't, you know, they won't deliver it. There are many things that are developed by the military that are ready for corporations to come in and take over. That's how things happen in our world. A lot of our best technologies came out of the military. And so that's what I think is happening here. I think there's enough information here, like I said, to cancel out a percentage of gravity for motor vehicles and so forth, that we can save an awful lot of energy on a national level. Now, as far as full, you know, I mean, heavier objects, I mean, you just have to think of these are nuclear-powered aircraft that are flying at 60,000 feet in the 1950s that he's disclosing, so you can't even imagine what we have today if we were doing that successfully in the 50s. So, yes, they have it. But typically the next step is, you know, defense contractors, if they leak out a little bit of technology, corporations step in, private investors come in, I'm going to be doing some tests. They're very interested in my designs that I actually have developed over the years. I think I found a way to recycle the radio photons that, you know, normally they're just throwing away, you know, to produce this anti-gravity effect. I mean, John Hutchison's Tesla coils that he's using essentially take electricity, energy, and they run it through Tesla coils, and it turns into radio waves, and it produces the effect. But where do all the radio waves go? You see, they're scattering into space. Now, if you can capture those, and I found a way to magnify and compress them and recycle them, then you don't need to keep dumping in tons and tons of energy to produce lift. The system gets self-perpetuating and much more efficient. And that is an idea. I don't know if they've thought of that, and I have exact designs on how that actually happens. So I don't know if we've gotten beyond using nuclear sources for very high energy formulas to produce lift. I think that there's a way to do it for a lot less energy.
Because one of the
things Boyd said is in the Roswell craft when they examined it is there was no evidence for any power source or electricity or requirements or light bulbs.
Right.
That's amazing.
Okay, let's go to Danny in Reno, Nevada. You're on with David.
Hi. How are you guys doing tonight?
Well,
I had a curious question. I know it didn't want to turn out to be a sightings, you know, thing, but it all correlates because I do believe what I witnessed was an actual test flight drill of several of these UFOs. And they were doing similar test patterns on the ocean. And upon witnessing this, you know, we also noticed other UFOs in the area that this was covering, and they were doing some amazing. It was the night before New Year's Eve, and we were out this little past Malibu, and
Point Magoo.
Yeah, absolutely. Right in that cove there. It's called Deer Creek Canyon Road there. Absolutely.
What year?
It was the year of '97. It was going to be '98.
Mm-hmm.
It was the night before New Year's Eve.
There were tons of sightings in Topanga and the Palisades during those.
Yeah,
years.
During that time. Yeah, we actually also seen the triangle one, and it actually we were out in Malibu. We used to Baja around there on Mulholland, but that's getting away. But we also seen the triangle thing, and it actually interfered with our radio. But we've noticed we were mentioning like the radio's not on; it's the tape player. So, but anyway, yeah, we were seeing these, and they were doing all similar test flight patterns, and then it would all come back to the initial area that they were hovering at. And then we witnessed other several larger. At the time, they were like glowing, you know, lights, and so we were just blown away, fascinated, just beyond. You know, it was actually just changing their spectra of their religion. They had to like fight back, but they were consciously seeing this. You know, some of my friends. And
mm-hmm. Well, all right, Danny, we appreciate it. Do you have a question?
The question is that okay? I had, and then after seeing this, that we basically were like X-rayed on our way out of the canyon. I got sick, and another larger craft came over us, and I absolutely, it was not, you know, from the government. It was the extraterrestrials, and I do believe they were. My question is, does any of his file or anything tell what kind of species that they're dealing with this?
All right. Let's take that as a question.
Well, the radiation, if he got sick, you know, like Betty Cash did, he was exposed to nuclear radiation, and that would mean a nuclear power supply, and I would say that was probably one of ours. I really don't believe they're using harmful radiation to go from one star system to another. They'd all be dead before they got here, so that's not a good sign. I would go in and get tested and see if you've gotten cancer or any kind of ill health effects from your experience.
Mm-hmm. Did he have anything to say about the alien species?
No, I didn't even ask questions like that because I think I will do that at another step, you know, in my friendship with him. So maybe he'll tell me that. I don't know if he will.
Okay. All right, but he knew all the information he was giving you was going to come out in a movie or come out on the radio or whatever.
He signed a release document that says all rights. So I have all rights to the interview. And, you know, there's a lot here. There's so much that I couldn't put all of it in the film.
Got it. Gary in Jacksonville, Florida, you're on with David Sarita. Hi.
Hey, Art. Hey, David. Hey, I've got two quick questions. As far as the Roswell incident, I've seen many documentaries on that. Some of them say there were two crafts. Most of the ones I hear are one. Now, if you're saying that we shot one down, why did Mac Brazel have to contact the police and the authorities and the military to come out there? You would think they would have been on it. And the second question I had, have you ever heard of an alien that was supposedly working with the military named J-Rod?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard of the case of the J-Rod. It's another one of these witnesses at Area 51 who had contact with an alien. But, you know, as for Roswell, remember, if you look at all the mass sightings all over the country, as I mentioned earlier in the show, there was way more than one craft. I mean, there were nine of them at Edwards Air Force Base on July 8th. And there's actually a case in North Hollywood on July 9th, which is very interesting. So there were cases all over the country. So, you know, did they shoot down one or two of them? Why didn't the aliens shoot back? I mean, there's a lot of questions that start flying. You just have to think of when we send, you know, a probe to Mars, do we arm it with nuclear weapons in case we run into aliens? No. We
right. Okay. I just only ever heard of, you know, one or two on Roswell on that day.
No. There's lots of there's three. There's one in the plains of St. Augustine. There's the ones at Roswell. And then there's the one in, what's it called, Socorro, New Mexico.
Yeah,
there's three crash sites. So it's possible there are numerous saucers that went down.
Okay. Andrew in Richland, Washington. You're on with David Sarita.
Hi. I have a question. I recently moved up to Washington from Southern California. I was located in the a little place called Antelope Valley. It had we had Edwards Air Force, NASA, Lockheed, Skunk Works, all that around. And at night you would see stuff in the air, unexplained. And during the days, you would see I've seen weird things. They would test all the experimental airplanes and stuff out there. My question is pretty much it with you talking to Mr. Bushman. Was there any discussion that in that area that they were housing and developing and possibly even test testing out extraterrestrial aircraft, because that area where I moved from was they did a lot of experimental testing with
I really go into Edwards Air Force Base in my film. I mean, Gordon Cooper testified that his crew filmed a double lenticular, double wing shaped flying saucer landing in the dry lake bed and then flying off. I believe that was one of ours. There's no way aliens, previously having shot them down, they would land in an unfriendly military environment. I believe what Cooper filmed was one of these nuclear-powered, you know, saucers. And then you have Major Bob White, who's test flying the X-15 going Mach 6. He testifies on July 26, 1961 or 2 in Time magazine that he saw a, you know, rectangular-shaped gray object flying right next to him. He's going Mach 6. Who else can go Mach 6? You know what I mean? So that's also at Edwards Air Force Base. And I used to skydive out there. I did my high altitude training at the base, so I'm familiar with it. I shot a lot of footage of the the B-1 bomber, the F-117 at the air show last summer. So I've got all that footage in the film.
David, for the record, he claims that which was at Area 51 was moved. Where does he say it was moved?
He says candidly, Tooele, Utah. He said because of the encroachment of the public into Area 51, they moved to Tooele, Utah.
Well, I wonder then why they felt it necessary to do a more of a land grab around Area 51 to enlarge the area.
Yeah, I mean, you think about how close Vegas is to. Well, it's not that close to Area 51, but. You know, it's funny. I went on Google Earth, and we went into Area 51, and you can see everything really clear on Google Earth. And what we found were there were two facilities where there was this purple-violet kind of aura around two different buildings. And it definitely was not a reflection from the sun, because there were other buildings that were white that had similar kind of materials, and there was no purple aura. So this weird, very psychedelic-looking purple aura on two of the different facilities there. But he's saying candidly to Tooele, Utah in the film. And I just let that breeze by me, you know, so I can go on to the next subject. And people I know who live out there in Utah say that is in the middle of nowhere. I mean, they say nobody goes out there to Tooele, Utah. It's like southern New Mexico when you go to the very large array, you know, the telescope array down there. There's nothing down there. It's like that in Tooele, Utah. So it's a good place for them to test these things, because nobody's going to get anywhere near them. They're nowhere near any cities, any towns. There's just nothing out there. So,
well, if people hear this, there might be people out there.
Well,
shortly.
But the thing is, if you look at how large the landmass is out there, where outside of Tooele, Utah? I mean, it's like, I don't know. But I have heard stories already from people who live in Utah that are friends of mine that they see strange things in that area, yes.
Okay, David Sirita is my guest, and we're talking about just all kinds of things, and I guess we're going to be hearing a lot more from Boyd Bushman. If I know the disclosure community after this, they'll be all over him. I'm Art Bell. This is Coast to Coast AM. My guest is David Sirita. We'll get right back to him from sfgate.com. The following: top investigators of the Columbia space shuttle disaster are analyzing a startling photograph snapped by an amateur astronomer from a San Francisco hillside that appears to show a purplish electrical bolt striking the craft as it streaked across the California sky. The digital image is one of five snapped by the shuttle buff at roughly 5:53 a.m. Saturday, as sensors on the doomed orbiter began showing the first indications of trouble. 7 minutes later, the craft broke up in flames over Texas. The photographer requested that his name not be used, said that he would not release the image to the public until NASA experts had time to examine it. Presumably that should have occurred by now, although there are several possible benign explanations for the image, such as barely perceptible jiggle of the camera as a time exposure. NASA's zeal to examine the photo demonstrates the lengths to which the agency is going to tap the resources of ordinary Americans in solving the puzzle. Now, by now, you would imagine that they would have examined and given a report on those photographs. David Sirita will be right back. Okay, David, we've covered a ton of material here. Is there anything in the program that we absolutely should have gotten on the air that we've missed or have not yet covered?
Well, just a little bit of finishing up. It's interesting what you just read, because I just got an email from a former shuttle Boeing Rockwell engineer, space shuttle engineer. He's very interested in the discussion about the purple corkscrewing wave. And I wanted to add that I interviewed an investment banker who was in Dallas the day the shuttle went down, and him and his lawyer were looking through their Zeiss binoculars, and they saw two flying saucers clearly, and one was maroon or purple in color, which would match the color of the purple corkscrewing wave. And is it possible, he suggests, that because he's read my whole report and he has seen all five photographs now, that it was actually a saucer that was pursuing the shuttle? And why? The question, of course, is why. Well, we know we've shot at them, but the question is, why would they shoot at the space shuttle if that is what we were actually dealing with here? And this particular person, you know, has a name, a Boeing Rockwell shuttle engineer, is very interested. I'm not going to give his name on the air because he wants to have a conversation with me. So.
Okay.
But that's who's listening out there.
All right. All right. Michael in Norfolk, Virginia, you're on with David Cerita.
Yes. Hi. I didn't hear if you said my name. This is Michael. David, I'm sure that if Art Bell had known 6 years ago, well in advance, that he was going to be given a map to two dead Bigfoots, he would have been able to plan well in advance how he would handle such a gift. Now, you've been given a gift, and I'm sure that it has occurred to you that it may have come from persons or a person much higher and much more influential than this gentleman scientist. And my question to you is this. Now, if you use this information, obviously they knew you would put it in a film. But thinking beyond that, you've been given this gift. What are you going to really do with it in order to qualify for very much more than what you've already been given? It takes planning. You have to think. You have to organize. You want to become energy czar? Who are you going to put around you to help you build the organization that will produce the technology in a responsible way so we won't set off a mafia war between major industries in this country, like the oil industry, trying to fight for their own survival in the face of this new technology that you're going to produce? You got to plan. You got to think. There's 32 hours of live programming on Coast to Coast every week. Let's say we give you 1 hour out of those 32 every week. What are you going to do with it? Give us your plan.
Well, it's a great question you're stating. I mean, do I have a plan? Yes. I think about this stuff every day. And in fact, I think who I'm in association with, there's no question that if this can be engineered. You know, here's the reason I believe, in a nutshell, probably why they haven't given this stuff out, the secret to anti-gravity, for so long. Why? Because it's so darn simple. It's like you pick up your cell phone every day and you use it, and you just take for granted, you know, the years and generations of scientists that led to that, you know, revelation, and how simple it is to us. Yeah, you just pick it up, you plug it in, and you're talking to people all over the planet. I think when we really see how anti-gravity works, we're going to go, wow. I mean, anyone... You know, once you understand how it works, it's so simple. The mechanics of the technology is very simple, and I don't even think it's something you can control. Everyone is going to have it. But everybody does need to have it if we're going to live sustainably on the planet. What is my plan? I mean, my plan is to get funding from the film to do small-scale experiments to see if I can cancel out even 25% of the gravity for a motor vehicle, and that will be step one. You know, step two, try to get to 50%. I wouldn't want to reduce any more than 50 or 60% of a vehicle that has tires, because if it gets too light, when you hit the brakes, it's not going to stop. It's going to go skimming across the surface of the highway. So, you know, the next level of this, it obviously gets into trying to, you know, defy gravity 100% and revolutionize And you think of all those Star Wars movies, you know, when you see those things hovering around and how much visually we take that for granted in these films, we haven't figured that out yet. It's so simple. And I think that is the key. That is the key. It's so simple that when once people know how the blueprints of how this thing actually works, it's not going to be something you can control. We're just going to have to accept. This is one of the problems that a caveman mentality kind of has. They think that, okay, if everyone has anti-gravity, the oil companies say, well, I can't sell you oil anymore. What am I going to do? What's going to be the next commodity? If energy is not going to be a commodity anymore that's worth very much, because anyone can stick up a solar panel and, you know, once you can use that electricity to cancel out gravity, tiny little ion thrusters will send your little Jetsons mobile at, you know, 500 miles an hour, no problem. Once you have that, what's the next commodity? Well, if you give 100,000 people the ability to go interstellar, what are they going to discover out there? What commodities and jewels and other planets in our galaxy are they going to discover that could benefit and could be traded in a free marketplace for all of the interstellar community and humanity? Obviously, if you get rid of that control, that we're going to go to a much better place. We're going to find things out there that are going to benefit us on such a profound level. We'll have new commodities. There will be new things that we can buy, sell, and trade. So that fear of getting out of the dark ages and not being able to get off the planet, you know, that will, we will triumph over that. And we have to do it together. I really believe that, again, it's so simple that it's going to be like a light bulb. Oh, yeah, yeah, anybody can do a light bulb now, right? Well, when you were the guy who invented it, it wasn't so easy.
All right, David. Well, I hope you're right, because if we don't find something pretty soon, there will be no escape. John in Georgia, you're on with David Cerita.
Hey, David. Hey, Art. How you guys doing?
All right.
Good. How are you?
All right. Hey, Art. Love your show, man. Listen, I just got one simple question. I've heard you on the show with Art before a lot, David. And I've heard you talk about your film From Here to Andromeda many times, but I never heard you mention Mr. Bushman before. So my question is, all the times you've talked about your film before, why haven't you mentioned Mr. Bushman? How come he hasn't come to the forefront of the discussion? And basically, that's my question.
All right.
Well, basically, because as I've been talking about the film, I've been filming. I just finished editing today. It's a four-hour film, which means it has four 1-hour segments or parts. You know, people aren't going to watch it all at once. And this thing really moves. There's never a dull moment. It's moving. So that's the answer to the question. I didn't know I was going to get an interview with Boyd Bushman. I didn't, you know, in the 8-month period or so that I've known him, I didn't understand what he was going to give me until I got on a plane, flew to Dallas and met him and went, oh my God, you know, this guy's giving me everything here. So that answers it.
All right. Pete in Seattle, you're on with David Cerita. Hi.
Yes, David, Art, do you happen to know what came of the Disclosure Project with National Press Conference? In 2001 of May, a panel of experts from military, intelligence, government, corporate, scientific witnesses came forward, and they were going to testify their sightings and facts before Congress. Do you happen to know what came of that?
You're talking of the Stephen Greer Project, right?
Correct.
Well, of course, we had Stephen Greer on several times. David, have you been in contact with Stephen Greer with reference to some of the material you've talked about tonight?
No, I haven't. I met him when he was just starting out. That's the only time I met him in Santa Barbara. And I remember you said that on a show before. I've made attempts to contact him, and he never writes me back. So I would love to talk to Stephen. We just never have done that. I don't know why. I've made my attempts. He's never made a single attempt to talk to me. So I believe the secret to zero-point energy is a combination of canceling out the forces down towards the zero point as well as increasing the energy that you apply. But it's more about transformation of mass in the zero-point equation than it is about trying to get more and more energy, higher and higher levels of energy. Because you just encounter more and more inertia, and you can't go faster than the speed of light when you approach it that way. If you don't approach the problem with canceling out the forces of gravity and inertia, then you're never going to get beyond the speed of light. And the speed of light isn't even fast enough to get anywhere. So you really got to go way beyond that, and that's where the 7th, 8th, and 9th force get more interesting than anti-gravity.
All right. Don in Omaha, Nebraska. Your turn with David.
Good evening, Art, and good evening, David. I hope
evening.
You're both doing well.
Good evening.
My question is kind of a brief two-part question. First of all, to what extent, David, do you think that big oil, or whatever you want to call it, has kept us from seeing this kind of system before? And the other part of my question is, do you think, either one of you, I guess, that big oil, possibly through this administration, is making a last big grab for money because they can see this kind of thing coming down the pike a little ways?
They can see the Egyptian-like symbols on the wall, as it were.
Well, we can already see the end of oil. The question is, can oil see its end and be smart enough to invest in the future? You know, like I said, their fear is they're not going to have a commodity because we rely on goods and services in this country to move dollars, that they don't see any more commodities that they can sell us every day. But if you consider 100,000 people with spaceships going to the stars, there will be commodities beyond commodities in it that we will be able to transform our lives with. So they don't. The fear is unjustified at this point. We have to get beyond this point. We all die, or we all succeed. And the only way we're going to succeed is to get beyond oil. So these people have to stop threatening and intimidating, progress. I mean, this is the country where every great invention happened first, and it's going to happen again. And the next big revolution is going to happen, and it's going to be anti-gravity.
To what degree do you think big oil has suppressed whatever's out there?
When I personally was raising money for helium-3 fusion for Bogdan Castle, Magwitch, and Glenn Seaborg and the whole gang, and they were very urgent about it. They would not even let me off the phone. They said, you do not understand who we are. And I said, oh, yes, I do. And in 1989, in 1990 when I was doing that, back then, we didn't see the end of oil. Today, we can see the end of oil. So the question is, are they going to be barbarians and prevent us from evolving?
Okay, let's move to Michael in Chicago. You're on with David Sarita. Hello.
Hello, Art. Hello, David.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I'd like to confirm the NEPA saucer, the nuclear energy for propulsion of aircraft within the military-industrial complex. The way I created that illustration, David, is when I contacted that top-secret Q magic clearance engineer who worked for General Electric, he specifically told me about that aircraft. He also mentioned that it was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, Hangar Number 4, Bay E. This was 1960. And so I basically asked him, and the way this came about is, many of your listeners may recall Leonard Stringfield and his briefing documents with respect to crash retrievals. And I got a hold of a rare copy of one of his manuscripts that he sent to J. Allen Hynek in Chicago. And he, you'll notice that he never released the names of his contacts on all his briefing papers. But in this particular one, he did. And he didn't black out the names of the people on this list. And I was able to look and read the names under what he had blacked out. And so I called these people on this contact list. And this gentleman, who is a retired General Electric engineer working on this program in 1960, he was on that list. And that's how this illustration came to be.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, did he, when he spoke to... with respect to Roswell, did he give you any indication that it might have been a disinformation program from Air Force OSI?
No, I mean, I've seen FBI documents that state that it was a crash weather balloon, and I believe those are disinformation for the FBI so that they would not have access. So there are disinformation documents out there, that testify that, it was a weather balloon and little, dummies and that sort of thing. But
okay.
There are so many blurry lines here. I am just going by a man with high, high credibility who has a track record a mile long who said he personally knows the person who engineered the nuclear-powered flying saucer. So the diagram, in a way, is irrelevant. He's personalized it. The second part is that about Roswell, that he knows the Navy doctor who treated the pilot who told the story of how he shot this thing down in 1947. 47. So considering the credibility of your expert witnesses, I would say there's a very high degree of probability that everything they're saying is true. And
right.
They did describe alien bodies.
So, yep, that's yeah. Right. All right. Jeffrey, in North Hollywood, California, you're on with David.
Hey, last caller, looks like. How you guys doing? I'm sort of ironic that I live right down the street, or actually I have two places where that UFO crashed in North Hollywood on Magnolia Boulevard. Believe it.
Really?
Yeah. Actually, I have photographs of that UFO that crashed. It was the size of a large turkey platter. And it was, you know, the Project Have Blue, because a lot of UFOs have this blue aura around it. This thing was glowing with a blue aura around it when it hit this guy's wall in an apartment on Magnolia near Colfax.
Yeah, I have that in my film. And the interesting thing about that saucer is it's aluminum. It's 30 inches in diameter. And Boyd Bushman says aluminum, and he demonstrates this right in front of me, interface with certain fields actually taps into the sixth or anti-gravity force. There's something about aluminum. And as I've gone over the Majestic documents, there are so many accounts of eyewitnesses describing the saucers to look like polished aluminum. So the question in that North Hollywood case is, they say it's a 16-year-old kid who testifies that he built this thing, and it produced anti-gravity. It had a radio tube mounted in the center of it. The question is, where's this kid today, and where did he get the information? And his saucer crashes on July 9th, 1947, days within the Roswell incident. So what is going on?
David, we are out of time. What about your film? When is it available? Are all four parts now available, or what?
All four parts are being delivered this week to the duplicating house, so we're taking orders now. We should start shipping in a couple of weeks. So from here to Andromeda.com is where you can order the film. And it's 4 hours long. There's a lot of material here. It's all shot in high definition. It's beautiful quality, lots of graphics, and incredible interviews. Robert Thurman, Tibetan Book of the Dead translator for the Dalai Lama, is in the film. David Phelps, professor of psychology at Santa Monica College. Boyd Bushman.
All right. We've got to hold it there, David. Thank you, my friend.
Right,
incredible program. Good night.
Good night.
And to all of you out there, until next weekend, I'm Art Bell. Good night, all.